This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We have a cornucopia of stories for you on today's program. Later in the program, we'll talk about Lebanon. This nation just celebrated the 75th anniversary of its independence, but it's clearly being taken over by Iran. However, you shouldn't expect that trend to continue much longer. We're going to hear a report on this from Brent Noctegal, our Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem, that gives us a picture of Lebanon's immediate future. We also have a report on an explosive situation in South Africa where a prominent politician is demanding that his followers kill white people. We've been tracking deteriorating race relations in this country for many years. The situation looks ready to get far worse very quickly. And I'll conclude with a last word contrasting the view of Jesus Christ presented in Christmas with the one presented in the Bible. We're going to start, though, talking about German politics. Chancellor Angela Merkel announced her resignation from her political party at the end of October, and earlier this month, the party chose her replacement. We'll learn about who it was and the ramifications for Germany and for Europe in this report from Richard Palmer.
Europe is angry. You see this in the yellow vest riots that have swept France, Belgium, and elsewhere. You see this in the rise of extreme parties, like in Spain, where the far right just recently was voted into a regional parliament, the first time anything like that had happened in Spain's democratic history. You see this in Sweden, where the nation has spent the last 3 months without a government, after support for far right parties have made it almost impossible for stable coalitions to form. And in Germany, Europe's largest and most powerful nation, this trend is especially important. A recent INSA poll put the far-right Alternative for Deutschland at 15% of the vote, and then the far-left Left Party at 10%. So between those two, one in four Germans want to vote for one of these radical smash-the-system type groups. Some more figures just published very recently show that the number of Germans seeking a weapons license has seen a massive increase in 2018. The amount of small arm permits issued has jumped 130% compared to 2014. So more than doubled. Now, faced with this continent-wide anger, this apprehension, this fear for one's own safety, that these statistics just give us a glimpse of, Germany's ruling party, the Christian Democratic Union, met on December 7th to determine the course of their future. Who would they elect as their new leader? And in the end, the final round of voting came down to a simple choice. On the one hand, they had Friedrich Merz, a strong critic of German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who wants to take that party, Germany's ruling party, and the whole nation in a very different direction. He wanted to move the party much more to the right to address some of these concerns about migration. On the other hand, you had Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer. She was Miss Merkel's preferred candidate, one that Miss Merkel used her speech at that conference on that day to really promote and support. Now, she does, of course, have some differences with Miss Merkel, but she has earned the nickname Mini Merkel because she is very much Miss Merkel's disciple and follower. So faced with this decision, this choice between a change of direction for the party and for Germany, or more of the same, the Christian Democratic Union chose more of the same. Kramp-Karrenbauer won 51.8% of the vote. So despite all of the turmoil that we began with talking about, they chose more of the same. And this is going to cause the anger towards Germany's political classes and its mainstream parties to grow. It's going to cause more to turn to those left-wing and right-wing extremist parties that are all about trying to bring down the system, bring on a new political system. Now, in the immediate future, Ms. Merkel aims to continue in her job as chancellor, and then Kramp-Karrenbauer would take over if the CDU wins the next national elections, which are currently scheduled for 2021. Now, what is left of Ms. Merkel's chancellorship is still founded upon a very unstable coalition. So she is certainly not safe until 2021. But with Kramp-Karrenbauer in office, she is much more secure in the short term. As The Guardian put it, had Merz won, the pundits would now be asking how long he would need to topple Merkel. Now, they're asking how long Kramp-Karrenbauer will be able to keep Merkel in power. Now, in 2016, Trumpet.com managing editor Brad McDonald and I wrote on the German leader's refusal to change course on the migrant crisis. And in that article, we wrote, think about the consequences of German officials' deception. So back then, there were a lot of reports coming out showing that German officials were trying to cover up the level of migrant crime. Newspapers didn't want to report on it. They just didn't really want to think about the downsides that came with mass migration. That article continues, it is destroying the trust between Germany's government and the public. What happens when the majority of Germans realize they've been deceived? What happens when the majority of Germans lose confidence and trust in mainstream leaders? Frustrated and angry, the German people, as any people would, will seek an individual, a political party, willing to heed their concerns and solve Germany's migrant crisis. The trend is already evident in the dramatic rise of Pegida and the Alternative for Deutschland, a right-wing political party whose popularity is at all times high. 2 years later, we have seen that trend greatly accelerated. That trust for so many has been destroyed. That confidence is lost. People are turning to those extreme political parties. And yet, Germany's leadership still refuses to listen to those concerns. They had that very clear choice just at that leadership election. And they chose still not to listen. You see the same trend of anger and losing confidence in leaders all across Europe, as I said. And now, though, it's not just about migrants. It's about things like the economy. In France, it's about things like carbon taxes. Overall, it's just a general feeling of being powerless, of it doesn't matter who you vote for, nothing changes. That's the sentiment that you see in the yellow vest protests going on in France right now. You see it with just voters in Germany. You see it with people choosing the far right in Spain. You see it in Sweden. That's one of the big common denominators across Europe. Well, no matter who we vote for, nothing changes. We have no power. And it's leading to this rise of angry crowds all across Europe. They don't have a clear vision of what they do want, but they know that they're not happy with the status quo. And that the existing democratic process that's in front of them shows no sign of fixing their problems. So it's a growing anger that's not just directed at one person, policy, or party, but at the entire system. Back in 2016, we wrote, the Merkel's government's handling of this situation is turning the German people into a ticking time bomb. The more disillusioned, frustrated, and angry the German people become, the more vulnerable they will be to radical politics and radical leaders with radical solutions. And this refusal to change course, this election of mini Merkel, this choice of more of the same, in the long run, that's going to lead to just more disillusionment within Germany, more frustration, more anger. By ignoring all of this background, the Germany CDU is just making the resultant explosion worse. The Bible reveals the result of all of this anger. It reveals that an entirely different political system is coming to Europe. These radical smash the system type individuals, well, they're just going to grow and they're going to have some success. Revelation chapter 17 describes 10 kings that submit to one overall king. That's a very different system of government that we see right now of 27 democracies submitting to a big messy bureaucracy. Now, sure, the EU is not particularly democratic, but on the national level, you don't see 10 kings there. And you certainly don't see one king in power, one individual with monarch-like authority. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry explained in the latest issue of the Trumpet magazine that the soon-coming ruler could literally be called a king, even if he is not. The Bible gives him that title. When the Bible talks about a king, in most places it is not referring to a democratic government. Even if this man doesn't have the title of king, he will lead like an absolute monarch, like an authoritarian king, right out of the Middle Ages. Daniel chapter 8 describes the same individual, and Mr. Flurry, writing about that, said that Daniel's vision shows that the leadership of Europe is about to get a lot more authoritative. It's not hard to imagine this happening, considering the growing appetite within Germany and Europe for exactly this type of leadership. Daniel 11 and verse 21 says that this leader will not be given, quote, the honor of the kingdom, but shall instead come in by flatteries. And that's the term it uses in the King James there, flatteries. But it's describing someone who doesn't come in through the honorable or the orthodox ways. He comes in an unusual way, perhaps even an illegitimate way. He comes into office not through the normal channels of standing for election as the leader of a party. Revelation 17 also describes Europe being led by a, quote, a great whore, in biblical symbolism, a false church. So you look at the overall picture here. You've got a strong leader not coming in through normal channels, not elected, a continent led by a church. Those are big changes for the government of Europe. But this is where Europe has been time and time again throughout history. Many people think Europe is too modern to go back to these kind of Holy Roman Empire style of government with a strong leader and a strong church. But many of those people are also probably shocked to see the anger building in Paris and the strong calls for even revolution on the streets of France. Going back to that same article, Mr. Flurry wrote, "Current conditions in Europe, including the refugee crisis and the turmoil in German politics, provide probably one of the greatest opportunities ever for a new leader to come into power by flatteries. Chancellor Merkel is on her way out and is now a lame duck. Expect political and social crises in Germany and Europe and public resentment and anger to grow even deeper." This is what the recent election of Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer has accomplished in Germany, just helping that resentment and anger to grow even deeper. It's leading to that backlash into a completely different style of government. Now, if you've not already, be sure to read Mr. Flurry's cover article from that latest Trumpet edition, "Germany, a New King is Imminent." That will give you the prophetic background you need to understand the tumultuous news coming out of Europe. It shows where these world events are leading, and it shows you how these events fit in with God's plan for the whole world.
Well, thank you for that, Richard. Let's just talk a little bit, first of all, about more about the factors that forced Merkel to resign her position in the first place. What's happening within Germany that created so much pressure on her that she had to step down?
So if you go back a little over a year, they had that big election in Germany for chancellor or for the whole national parliament. Mm-hmm. And the result was Germany's longest period in its post-war history without a government, mm-hmm. where there were no clear winners, where typically you go back to the 90s and especially the early 90s, you usually had the main right-wing party, the CDU, the main left-wing party, the CSU. I'm gesturing with the wrong hands, but no one can see that. And they both had nearly 50% of the vote each. And it was pretty binary, just these two parties. And if one of them got towards 50%, they'd win the election. You fast forward to this result and everything has changed. You've got the Christian Social – or the Social Democratic Party, the main left-wing party, going from consistently getting 40-50% of the vote to winning around 20%. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, Germany's not a two-party system anymore. It's a four- or five-party system. And then to make matters even worse, you also have a very significant chunk of Germans voting for extreme parties – the Alternative for Deutschland on the right and the Left Party on the left. Both of these parties are kind of so extreme that none of the mainstream ones will work with them, at least at the federal level. So when you start looking at the results, it becomes almost impossible to make a coalition. How do you do it? The traditional right-wing parties can't get enough to have a coalition. The traditional left-wing parties can't win enough to get a coalition. Nobody wants to include the extremist parties. And so you just get this very – you get a long negotiation, and the results of that is a weak government that took a long time to put together and can't really do much. Mm-hmm. That's what you saw. And right away, you saw the government shaking. You saw just within the first few months, crises where it nearly fell apart, where especially the Christian Social Union, Angela Merkel's traditional, well, her sister party, nearly pulling the whole thing apart over migration. So this whole thing was clearly unstable. Mm-hmm. Coming then into the autumn, you have regional elections for Germany's different regional parliaments. And it was clear that voters did not like this coalition and that all the parties involved in it were rejected by the voters. And so there was a lot of pressure coming then on the head of this coalition, Angela Merkel, to step down. And not just as head of the coalition, but really the main figure in German politics for the past two decades that has had so much to do with us even being in the position where Germany's mainstream parties don't get much of a vote. A lot of her decisions have been behind that. And so it was just this last whole year of unstable politics, unstable coalitions and paralysis, really, that led to her feeling like, well, I need to step down and make way for a new era in German politics now.
Right. And just give us the bullet point list of those things that are happening that created that political crisis to begin with, where you have so many German voters saying, no, we reject the status quo. These mainstream parties that have been running the ship for all of these decades, they're not doing the job. We need to, and support is bleeding out into some of those extreme parties.
So the big thing would be migration.
Yep.
That you saw a lot of migrants coming in. You saw a lot of rising crime. You saw nobody want to talk about it. Another thing is that Angela Merkel has quite deliberately moved her party, the Christian Democratic Union, to the left. And she has sought coalition with the Social Democrats several times, which has led to people feel like it doesn't matter what we vote for, we always get the same vaguely left-wing policies. Mm-hmm. No matter, so our votes don't count. Our votes don't matter. Then the Euro crisis is what got the Alternative for Deutschland, this new upstart party, going in the first place. We've talked about how it's led to a lot of German power, and it has. But for German taxpayers, they don't like to see their money being used to bail out Greeks. And the message that they get is that the Greeks are lazy, that they cheat on their taxes, and they retire early, and we're having to bail them out. Whether or not that message is true, that's the perception for a lot of people in Germany. You have the 2008 financial crisis, where people feel like living standards have stopped improving, that the future's no longer going to get better. Our kids are no longer going to be more prosperous than we are. So all of these are just some of the things that feed into this dissatisfaction of where things are going.
So we've been tracking these trends all along because of, as you mentioned in your report, the Bible prophecies about someone coming in and offering a radical departure from the status quo. It's amazing. We've been predicting Angela Merkel's fall for years because of exactly these types of pressures that you're describing. With all the trouble Germany is facing, it's really quite remarkable how resistant to change the political establishment is. It makes you wonder what is going to have to happen before they would take more radical steps to address the concerns of the populace. We've talked a lot about this tendency within Europe generally, I guess Germany specifically, this tendency to keep kicking the can down the road. And essentially, that's what the CDU announced to the world. Yes, we're just going to continue business as usual by basically replacing Merkel with Merkel.
Yeah, I think in some ways there's a certain similarity to the deep state in the United States. There's a mainstream worldwide consensus, and getting any change to that is very hard. I mean, in America, you can even have a president that is opposed to that consensus, and he can have a very hard time challenging it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
In Germany, where you've got no really major politician out there that wants to challenge that, no matter how much voters want to change that, how do they do it? Mm-hmm. It's very hard to. And so you do get to this situation where, well, the only way they can change it is through an explosion. And so the pressure just keeps building and building and building. As we talked about in that report, it's the same pressure that's then leading to hundreds of thousands of people to come out onto the streets of France. I mean, they're much more volatile than the Germans are. It would be unimaginable, I think, for Germany to have, or it'd be a huge deal if Germany had a similar type violence to what we saw in France. But they're both responding to the same pressures.
Yeah. We've been talking with Richard Palmer about the new leader of the Christian Democratic Union in Germany and how events are building to a political explosion. Go to thetrumpet.com and read his article on the subject, As France Burns, Germany Chooses Mini Merkel. Find that on thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much for your time, Richard.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Lebanon is deeply influenced now by the terrorist group Hezbollah, which takes its orders from Iran. But there are indications this state of affairs could radically change, as we will now hear in this report from Brent Noctegal.
November 22, 2018 should have been a cause for celebration in Lebanon, as that date marked the 75th anniversary of Lebanon's independence from France. However, no one was celebrating an independent and sovereign state this year. This year, it's more apparent than ever that Lebanon is no longer independent, but is instead beholden to Iran. Now, Iran achieves this level of control through the patronage of the Shiite group Hezbollah. And while we in the West understand Hezbollah to be a terrorist group, in Lebanon, Hezbollah is an official political party that actually won the most seats in the Lebanese parliament in an election earlier this year. Now, while it is true that Hezbollah is the largest political party in the parliament, most Lebanese are furious with how Hezbollah has ceded control of the country to Iran. It's often forgotten that Lebanon is the most religiously diverse nation in the Middle East. Lebanese Shiites, of which Hezbollah is the main political representation, only make up a quarter of the nation. And even then, not all Shiites support Hezbollah. It's far too easy to oversimplify the situation and write off Lebanon as being nothing more than an Iranian vassal. In fact, there are many indications right now that Lebanon is ready to throw off Iran's powerful hold, as it did the French and the Syrians. Even though elections were held 8 months ago, Lebanon is right now still without a functioning government. Ordinarily, this wouldn't be a huge issue. However, Lebanon is facing extreme financial pressure. Unemployment is over 50%, and public debt sits at 150% of GDP, making it one of the most indebted nations on earth. Add to this the fact that one quarter of those living in Lebanon are actually refugees from Syria, and you have a desperate need for cash. However, that financial aid will not come unless there is a government formed. The International Monetary Fund has demanded that Lebanon needs to legislate financial reforms before any of the loans can be given to the nation. So the government needs to be set up, and the government isn't set up, and there's a growing understanding in Lebanon that Hezbollah is to blame. By virtue of its diverse ethnic makeup, the Lebanese constitution calls for a division of seats and positions of power among the Sunnis, Shiites, Christians, and Druze. This is largely what has given Hezbollah the ability to control the political process, even though it doesn't hold a majority itself. It simply has to be the largest vote-getter of an inherently fragmented electorate. Since it is the main Shiite party, it garnered almost a quarter of all Lebanese votes. Hezbollah received its majority through coalition-making with some Christian and Sunni parties. However, even now, 8 months since the election, there's still no functioning government. The problem is that Hezbollah is refusing to allow the Sunni Prime Minister Saad Hariri from forming a government unless key portfolios are handed over to parliamentarians of Hezbollah's favour. As Carolyn Glick pointed out this week, Hezbollah is trying to control the health portfolio, which would give it control over $338 million. This would allow Hezbollah to funnel that money toward rewarding families of Hezbollah fighters who have died or been wounded in the fight in Syria. And this aid would come in terms of free social programs and healthcare, and they're essential for Hezbollah to provide for these people if they are to sustain their support among their base. However, Sunni leader and Prime Minister Saad Hariri is endeavouring not to give Hezbollah the health ministry because of pressure from the United States. According to Carolyn Glick, giving Hezbollah the health ministry or any upgrade in its government portfolios would cause a United States economic embargo and end the US support for the Lebanese armed forces. A cut to such US aid to Lebanon would be disastrous for the nation, not to mention the Lebanese armed forces. And so, the deadlock remains. And because Hezbollah holds the reins of power, the people are holding them responsible. Now, above the economic struggles that Hezbollah is causing, Lebanese are increasingly aware that Hezbollah's Iran-directed military endeavors are putting all of Lebanon on the firing line. Hezbollah's fighting force is estimated to have a standing army of about 30,000 men and a loaded missile arsenal that would rival some European nations. Hezbollah has long justified the existence of its paramilitary by saying that it's needed to protect Lebanon from Israeli attack in the south. However, when Iran deployed Hezbollah to prop up the Assad regime in the Syrian civil war, the Lebanese people began to realize that Hezbollah was serving more than just a defense to their southern front, but rather as another proxy force whose loyalties lie with Tehran rather than Beirut. Anger against Hezbollah has only increased with revelation this month that it's created attack tunnels to be used in an offensive mission against Israel. While most Lebanese would accept Hezbollah as a necessity against Israeli attack, they do not condone Hezbollah provoking Israel into a military response, a response that would threaten the lives of all Lebanese. Now, given both of these factors, Lebanese are getting more and more angry with Hezbollah and the hold they have over the nation. Earlier this week, the Middle East Media Research Institute Memory translated and published a series of powerful recent comments from Lebanese lawmakers and media personalities that had expressed their outrage at Hezbollah. Most of these comments came from either Sunni or Christian leaders, which together represent 70% of the nation, remember. Here is what Mustafa Alush said recently. He's a member of the Al-Mustaqbal Political Party's Political Bureau. Quote, "Lebanon, which Hezbollah has hijacked by force of arms, is unable to escape the circle of danger. The only solution is for Hezbollah to either return to the Lebanese fold or else leave Lebanon. The world must have sympathy for Lebanon and realize it has been hijacked and that great efforts must be made to free it from its captors." Former Minister Ashraf Rifi said this, quote, "Hezbollah wants to control what is still left of Lebanon's decision-making for Iran's sake. We say to Nasrallah, for the thousandth time, we bow only to God and belong only to Lebanon. Do not delude yourself that by raising your voice you can intimidate the free people of Lebanon. Your weapons do not frighten us. We will oppose your plan as long as we live. Lebanon has been hijacked. It's been imprisoned by Iran, and it's our responsibility to liberate it. We must oppose the Persian hegemony plan." This is what Sami El-Gamayel, the chair of the Khatib party, said. "We call on Hezbollah to take a courageous decision to reach out to all the Lebanese people in order to build a sovereign, free, independent, and stable Lebanese state. We call on it to subject itself to the authority of the constitution and laws. If Hezbollah continues to consider itself above the other Lebanese, permitted to do what others are not, it will eventually drive the public to launch an intifada against the existing situation." From these quotes, we see that many in Lebanon are very frustrated that Hezbollah is taking orders from Iran on policy that dictates the future of all Lebanese. Now, the more the power that Hezbollah garners in Lebanon, the more accountable they become for Lebanon's difficulties, be they economic or strategic. The Lebanese are not dummies. They recognize that their nation has been hijacked by a despotic power in Iran that obviously cares less for the Lebanese people than for its own, which is not to say much. And if history is our guide, when a nation is controlled by an aloof, irresponsive, and unsympathetic power 1,000 miles away, revolt is only a matter of time. But more than history, Bible prophecy says that Lebanon will eventually become free from Iranian domination at the hands of Hezbollah.
Well, thanks for that, Brent. So that is strong language from the Lebanese that you were quoting, that their country has been hijacked by Hezbollah. And I guess we just hear so much about Hezbollah and how entrenched it has grown. These voices we haven't heard from so much.
Yeah, and I think that's mainly just due to reporting, because some of those men that I quoted, they have been around for a while. One of them in particular has been leading the anti-Hezbollah revolt for a good decade. Mm-hmm. But others are slowly getting on board, becoming more vocal. And it does speak to the fact that they aren't scared to speak up about it as well. You might think that if this is a militarized state, that they wouldn't be able to have freedom of expression like this. But Lebanon is different than what we normally consider a Middle Eastern, generally think of Middle Eastern nations being Islamic. This nation is 40% Christian. Mm-hmm. It's 50% Muslim, but that's divided between Shias and Sunnis. So it's really ethnically diverse. And so, I mean, Beirut used to be owned or wasn't been challenged or control been given over to Iran and Hezbollah. It used to be one of the financial capitals of the Middle East, the party capital of the Middle East. All the Saudi princes would head to Beirut and party. That's where they would go. So it was very much a Western place. Yeah. And you still have remnants of that, or that still kind of exists there. And so, yes, when we think of Lebanon, we tend to think Hezbollah. And while they are the dominant factor in the nation now, yes, they are, there are plenty of other Lebanese that don't adhere to the tenets that Hezbollah does.
Well, it's good to keep these underlying realities in mind, because even though, say, you're hearing some of these voices coming from Lebanon, you don't hear analysts foretelling Lebanon actually breaking free of Hezbollah's influence. But let's talk about the prophecy, because we're looking at this differently. And I think some of these underlying realities that you're describing speak more to, or they would suggest more of the unfolding of events along the lines of what we see in the Bible.
Yeah, I'm very surprised, actually. There aren't more people coming out and talking about how Hezbollah has how Lebanon has the potential to be a disaster for Hezbollah, just given the demographics of the nation. Hezbollah is a minority. The Shiite factions are a minority in the country, and the Bible really does kind of Bible prophecy kind of really does flow from that fact as well, because we know that Lebanon, in terms of alliances, it is not going to be a part of the Iranian-led King of the South alliance that does push radical Islam, that does align with other political Islamic nations. And so from that fact, we know that Hezbollah is not going to dominate Lebanon in the long term. Or if they do, they are going to change their stripes. They are not going to allow themselves to be headed up by Iran. Hmm. Now, I think that's kind of probably out of the question. I think Hezbollah goes with Iran. I think Bible prophecy indicates that it would more like the Lebanese reject Hezbollah's policy, and instead they pick a course that is actually against what Iran is doing. And we can see that from two prophecies, basically, that talk about these end-time alliances in the Middle East. You have the King of the South, which, again, is headed by Iran. That's the Islamic power. They believe in the pushing of Islamic fundamentalism everywhere. They are the ones with the pushy foreign policy. And then you have the so-called moderate Islamic states that are aligned with Europe, actually, a German-led Europe. And this alliance is found in Psalm 83. We've written extensively about this. Our editor-in-chief has written extensively about this in his booklet, King of the South. And this is an alliance that all Bible commentaries show has not taken place in history. Mm-hmm. And so it's definitely a prophetic alliance, even though it's in the Book of Psalms. And we have the nation of Lebanon included in this alliance with a German-led Europe and moderate Arab states. Gebal and the inhabitants of Tyre are the two specific mentions to this territory of Lebanon in that prophecy in Psalm 83. And so from both of these prophecies, Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40, which talks about the king of the south, and then Psalm 83, we can tell that Lebanon is going to fall out of Iran's hold in favor of a European-led a moderate Arab state combine, which is interesting again, because if you look at historically, Lebanon, the fact that it is 40% Christian, and we know that this European power is going to be dominated by Catholicism as well, it really does make sense that Lebanon would be an important factor in a Middle Eastern alliance with Europe because of their religion.
Now, you talked about how the Lebanese are making these pronouncements. Hezbollah has hijacked our country and so on. You said revolt is just a matter of time. Do you find more evidence of that, say, than what these people are saying? Is there stirrings within the populace?
Well, yeah, I think right now the economic factor is huge because they don't have a functioning government. They can't get the loans that they need. And the United States right now, I mean, its policy is kind of firm on Hezbollah in Lebanon. They have the U.S. is not willing to give aid unless Hezbollah does not increase its positions of power in Lebanon. And at least that's the policy that's been shown to the Lebanese figures from cabinet inside Mr. Trump's government. He might change his mind about that, but that's at least the policy there. And so because there's not going to be any financial relief, the situation on the ground with 50% unemployment in Lebanon, that's just huge. And if people put that blame squarely at Hezbollah's feet because they don't want to give up they want to attain a greater position inside the government, then that will be turned on them. Right. This past weekend, there was the Yellow Vest protest in Beirut as well. There was a few thousand people that came out to protest the government. And so that groundswell can, if that grows, that can be directed towards Hezbollah as well. You do also have a lot of Shiite speakers that are coming out against Hezbollah. It's not like every Shiite follows Hezbollah either. And so, again, that's probably another something that we don't normally think about. And you do see anti-Hezbollah Shiites that are willing to flip over the tables. We also got to remember that a quarter of the population of Lebanon right now are Sunnis that have immigrated, basically, are refugees from Syria. They were escaping Syria. They weren't escaping the Islamic State. They were escaping Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, the way that they were treating them. And they have said, they came out today, a lot of them said, we're not returning to Syria. While that dictator's in power, he's going to have our heads. And so that's that demographic change. Now, I did say there was a quarter Sunnis and a quarter Shiites. Well, that's Lebanese population in terms of citizenry. Well, if you add another million Sunnis, you've got an extra population that would, if they had to, if it did become bloody, I'm not saying it necessarily will be that way, but that's another plus, I guess, for the Sunni side, the anti-Hezbollah side.
Well, it is good to dig into some of these numbers and look at just a more refined view of the complexities of Lebanese politics and some of the pressures on the country that could really push it politically in a direction very different than what we have seen. So we really do appreciate you giving us that look at what's going on there in light of what the Bible says. And we've been talking about for years expecting this kind of change within Lebanon. Interesting to see how that might unfold. We've been talking to Brent Noctegal about Lebanon's future, prophesied to be a break from Iranian influence. Watch thetrumpet.com for an article from him on this subject. Thanks for your time, Brent.
No problem.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Race relations in South Africa have been deteriorating for years, and the situation looks ready to get far worse very quickly, as we'll now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
A South African politician is demanding that his followers kill white people. At a rally held on December 9th, Andilim Gitama told a cheering crowd that for each black person that's killed by the taxi industry, his movement will kill five white people. Gitama is the president of Black First Land First, a communist party that demands the seizures of white-owned land without compensation. Yet his recent violent comments were referring to turf wars between taxi associations and individual minibus drivers. Here is an excerpt from his rally.
For each white person that is being killed by the taxi industry, will give five white people. For every one black person who kills, will give five white people. Who kill one of us, will give five of you. You kill one of us, will give five of you. You kill one of us, kill five of you. You kill one of us, will kill five white people. We'll kill the children, we'll kill the women, we'll kill anything that we find on our way.
Gitama is a Marxist revolutionary who was expelled from Julius Malema's Economic Freedom Fighters in 2015 for accusing Malema of being soft on land reform. That's quite an accomplishment considering that Malema was tried by South Africa's Equality Court for singing a song that calls for the shooting of white farmers with machine guns. Like Gitama, Malema wants blacks to confiscate white-owned land without compensation. But he is not openly calling for the slaughter of whites yet. In an interview with TRT World last June, Malema said he couldn't guarantee what violent calls he will make in the future. Here's a clip from that interview.
I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I'm saying to you, we have not called for the killing of white people, at least for now. I can't guarantee the future.
Yeah, but I mean, you'd understand somebody watching that, especially as it gets shared on Twitter, they freak out. It sounds like a genocidal call.
Cry babies. Cry babies.
I'm not calling for the slaughter of white people, at least for now.
I can't give you a guarantee of the future, especially when things are going the way they are.
Subtext.
Especially if things are going the way they are, there will be a revolution in this country, I can tell you now. There will be an alert revolution. An alert revolution is the highest form of anarchy.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa also believes that white-owned land should be confiscated without compensation. He called the taking of land from the indigenous peoples of South Africa the nation's original sin, and has made land reforms a main part of his leadership plan. Now South Africa's National Assembly has approved a proposal to amend the Constitution to begin such land seizures next March. Yet contrary to claims that white settlers stole black land, the Cape Colony was mostly uninhabited when Dutch settlers arrived there in 1652. The Dutch shared this land with a small number of Khoikhoi herdsmen for several years. Battles over grazing rights did eventually break out between the Dutch and the Khoikhoi, but the Bantu tribes that comprise most of South Africa's black population today did not even arrive in the region until a century later. Politicians are distorting history to unite blacks against those of European descent. Ramaphosa says he will not allow smash-and-grab land seizures, but Bible prophecy shows that Gautama's horrifying vision of violent revolution will become reality. The late Herbert W. Armstrong explained in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that the Anglo-Saxon peoples who settled the United States and the United Kingdom are the descendants of ancient Israel. The British, Dutch, and French peoples who settled in South Africa are also descended from Israel. This means that the Bible's end-time prophecies concerning Israel are directed at its modern descendants, primarily the United States, Britain, the modern Middle Eastern nation of Israel, as well as Australia, Canada, New Zealand, South Africa, and other nations. A sobering prophecy in Ezekiel describes a time of violence and race war that will soon afflict these nations. In Ezekiel 7, verses 23 through 25, it says, "Make a chain, for the land is full of bloody crimes, and the city is full of violence. Wherefore I will bring the worst of the heathen, and they shall possess their houses. I will also make the pomp of the strong to cease, and their holy places shall be defiled. Destruction comes, and they shall seek peace, but there will be none. Now, the word heathen in this passage isn't necessarily an insult. It comes from the Hebrew word goyim, and it just means non-Israelite. But the worst of the heathen refers to the type of non-Israelites who pledge to kill people, their women, their children, their dogs, and their cats. This prophecy in Ezekiel says that so many bloody crimes will occur in the end time that they will be like links in a chain, one following right after another. It also describes the seizure of people's homes and conflicts between Israelites and non-Israelites, a race war. But this passage should not be misinterpreted as a call to arms. This time of violence is coming because of the abominations or sins of the people. The Israelite people have a 4,000-year history with God, yet they've forgotten him and turned away from his laws. Therefore, God says in verse 27, I will do unto them after their ways, and according to their deserts will I judge them, and they shall know that I am the Lord. God's great desire is to teach all races and nationalities the way to peace. If mankind would only repent and obey God's commands, we would not have to experience such horrific crimes. But the human heart is hard and too proud to admit that it does not know the way to peace, happiness, and stability. Therefore, all who do not voluntarily repent before this coming time of tribulation will have to be humbled the hard way. God can only teach knowledge to those of a poor and contrite spirit, to those who tremble at his word.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Thanks, too, for looking up all of the pronunciations on some of those difficult South African names. But you were talking about the prophecy in Ezekiel. Maybe you could just talk about the where to go for more information about that, because those really are explosive prophecies that every individual living in an Israelite country should be very familiar with.
Right, because Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has a booklet, or actually it's not even really a booklet, it's more of a book now. It's grown over the years, called Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, which we advertise on this program often. And it's the fourth chapter is actually called Terrorism and Race Riots. And the news events in that chapter focus more on the United States and Britain than they do South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But as I mentioned, all the former British Commonwealth nations are included in those prophecies, and it does give a much deeper overview of the biblical prophecy background of like race wars and ethnic tensions that are coming on those of Israelite descent because of their rebellion against God. Yep. And so when you study that, you get a much deeper understanding of what the Bible says. And then once you know that, it's not hard to extrapolate the principle to what's happening in South Africa right now.
Yeah, we've even talked over the years about just how much some of the social problems, the race problems that you see in South Africa are really kind of the canary in the coal mine or early indicator of the kinds of problems that you're going to see spreading to other Israelite nations later on. And to see the state of those relations in South Africa now, it does help you to see how those prophecies specifically could be fulfilled on an even larger scale within the United States and Britain. We appreciate that. We've been talking with Andrew Miller about race relations in South Africa. He has an article he's posted at thetrumpet.com, South Africa on the Brink of Race War. You can check that out. And then also, for more information about that prophecy in Ezekiel he referred to, read that booklet by Gerald Fleury, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophecy. You can find that under the Literature tab on thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Every year, the noise of commercialism, materialism, and excess associated with Christmas seems to get worse. Some people try to remind others that this holiday is actually supposed to be about Jesus, But have you ever looked it up? If you just scratch the surface of any of the traditions associated with Christmas, you immediately start finding some rather grotesque things. The fact that December 25th isn't Christ's birthday is easy to prove. According to ChristianHistory.net, this is a service of Christianity Today, it was the day of the Roman birth of the unconquered sun and the birthday of the Iranian son of righteousness, Mithras. The new Schaff-Herzog Encyclopedia of Religious Knowledge says the pagan celebrations of Saturnalia and Brumalia were held on this date. Long before that, the Egyptians marked December 25th to celebrate the birth of the son of Isis. So Christmas, quote-unquote, celebrations preceded Christ's birth by centuries. And somewhere around three centuries after Jesus' death, church leaders decided to preserve the celebration but put Christ's name on it. Schaff-Herzog says the pagan festival with its riot and merrymaking was so popular that Christians were glad of an excuse to continue its celebration with little change in spirit and in manner. This fact didn't sit well with many pious believers at the time. The Bible doesn't advocate celebrating Christ's birthday, or any birthday for that matter. So, as Christian history explains, many believed, quote, it would be wrong to honor Christ in the same way Pharaoh and Herod were honored. Birthdays were for pagan gods. Schaff-Herzog further says, Christian preachers of the West and the Near East protested against the unseemly frivolity with which Christ's birthday was celebrated, while Christians of Mesopotamia accused their Western brethren of idolatry and sun worship for adopting as Christian this pagan festival. Christian history says the pagan origins of the Christmas date, as well as pagan origins for many Christmas customs, gift-giving and merrymaking from Roman Saturnalia, greenery, lights, and charity from the Roman New Year, Yule logs and various foods from Teutonic feasts. And to this list, we could add Santa Claus, who's an import from Nordic mythology, have always fueled arguments against the holiday. It's just paganism wrapped with a Christian bow, naysayers argue. Well, you can count me among the naysayers. But what's astonishing to me is how, for the Christian history writer and evidently many others who've learned of this background, the pagan roots of this celebration are nothing to be concerned about. This is how this Christian history article concludes. But while kowtowing to worldliness must always be a concern for Christians, the church has generally viewed efforts to reshape culture, including holidays, positively. As a theologian asserted in 320, we hold this day holy, not like the pagans because of the birth of the sun, but because of him who made it. And just like that, they embrace appropriating a whole closet full of pagan customs. And they assume God smiles on these efforts. But notice what it says in Jeremiah 10, verses 2 through 4. Thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen, for the customs of the people are vain or false. For one cuts a tree out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen, with the axe. They deck it with silver and with gold. They fasten it with nails and with hammers, that it move not. So this is a clear biblical directive. And given that fact, why would anyone cut down a tree, fasten it down in his home, and decorate it in order to celebrate anything, let alone to celebrate a holiday supposedly intended to celebrate the Jesus of the Bible? Doesn't God have the right to tell us how and how not he wants to be worshiped? Now, even though Scripture doesn't say when Christ was born, and it doesn't command us to celebrate his birth, it does command us to remember each year his death, the death that made possible the forgiveness of sin and the reconciliation of man and God. Anciently, the annual celebration of Passover, where each family killed an unblemished lamb, this foreshadowed the crucifixion of the Lamb of God. Jesus told his disciples to continue this annual memorial, not with animal sacrifices, but with new symbols of his broken body and his shed blood. You can read about this in 1 Corinthians 11, verses 23 through 26. So in Christmas, a humanly devised holiday, a Christian must overlook profane origins, accept a whole host of quirky pagan customs, and excuse the gross profiteering and the material excesses that becloud the whole season just to get a view of a newborn baby. But in Passover, a God-ordained memorial, a Christian remembers the history of a people of promise and remembers the miraculous protection from death and redemption from sin, not just Israel's, but also his own. And he sees the culmination of the perfect life of the Son of God, offered willingly as substitutionary payment for the sins of humanity, the greatest ever act of love. And Passover is just the first of seven biblically commanded festivals that collectively tell the story of God's entire master plan, past, present, and future. Unlike Christmas and other holidays that have origins in paganism, the deeper you study into these holy days, the more divine beauty and perfection you see. They show that the God of the Bible does everything with purpose and design. And what purpose he has for the plan that began with the perfect offering of Jesus Christ, the life and death of the Messiah. It is far, far greater and much more inspiring than most people realize. If you want to learn more about it and how it's presented in glorious symbol through God's annual holy days, request a free copy of Herbert W. Armstrong's wonderful booklet on this subject, Pagan Holidays or God's Holy Days, Which? I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Andrew Miller. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Life Magazine, December 1955. No doubt most Americans are less religious than they should be. They then owe a vast and continuing debt to the saving remnant in their midst, who do hunger and thirst for righteousness and walk humbly before their God. They do not do this for America's sake, but without them, America would be little more than a geographical expression. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.